Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
And Duane DeFreitas will be joining us a little bit later. So on this week's episode, the sky falls over Russia, Apple makes their own Pebble, Bungie announces their first non-Halo game in over 10 years, Google plans to launch stores and a new netbook to put them in, Sony's PlayStation 4, and Tesla drives the New York Times cray-cray. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And Tosin, there's a couple of things that you wanted to talk about that you've been playing with in the last week.
Yeah, there's been a couple toys that I've gotten my hands on. The first thing I'd like to talk about is the Parrot AR drone. So one of my colleagues actually brought it in over the weekend, and I flew this drone indoors. It's you may have heard of the AR drone from CES. The past few years, they've debuted the drone as well as other advancements in basically remote quadcopter. But it was one of the best drones which you could maneuver using just your iPhone or Android device as well as now your tablet. And so I got to play around with it a little bit indoors, and boy, will I say it was fun and extremely smooth to control. The touch screen was really intuitive on the iPhone that we were playing with. You could actually look directly with the camera. The drone has at least one 720p camera. I'm not sure the resolution of the secondary camera that's on it, but so gorgeous, really effortless to fly and maneuver around. I felt like in the first 5 minutes that I was flying it that I could have been a pro in being able to place it in whatever direction which I wanted it to go, as well as you can, of course, do little stunts. It actually outputs a lot of air to keep it afloat. It was a couple of my other colleagues sitting a good distance away could definitely tell that it was a lot chiller in the room at the time with all the air being blown across. But it was just – it was quiet and it was just really kind of sleek. It's the sleekest thing I've seen in a while compared to all the other quadcopters or helicopters that I used to play in back in the day, right? None of those would perform as well. And one of the really cool capabilities of it was you know, by simply just cutting the power, it would gently land and shut off appropriately without coming to like an abrupt crash or anything, any disturbances. So I was really, really pleased with it. And although the price tag is very high, it comes at a pricey $300 US. Yikes. Dollars. Yeah. I kind of really want to get one. It's just so amazing in terms of, you know, I've been watching a lot of user videos which show how high it can go and just how much distance it can cover. As well, I've seen a lot of cool modifications, people who've painted them to look, you know, added additional lights and LEDs. There was one modification which was actually kind of cool. It looked like a New York police trooper car. Oh, it had sweet. Those lights, and I was kind of a little worried that someone may look up and think that you know, they're being watched by the law. The federals have drones positioned all over the world. We're going to start conspiracy theories.
I was going to say, it'd be great to prank your paranoid friends.
What's that, a UFO? No, it's just an AR drone.
Hang on just a second. I think we have we can get Duane on the line here. Hey, how's it going?
I'm all right.
So, Tosin, what else have you been playing with this week?
So, in addition to the AR drone, I actually got to play a game which I had always heard about but never got a chance to try out. It's called Artemis Spaceship Bridge Simulator. And do you know what this game is about?
I don't. I took a look at it. I introduced myself to the game looking through your links, but I didn't. I was not familiar with this before you had, tweeted it.
It's pretty fantastic.
Oh, it's amazing. Really what this game is, it allows you to, as it says, simulate a spaceship bridge. So it's kind of like one of those games where you play as crew of starship, whatever you decide to call your starship, and you have various members. I think you can have at most 6 different crew members. One person plays the captain. You have an engineer, a scientist, each with different roles. So for example, the scientist searches out galaxies, sees where the enemy ships are, can also have the ability to see cloaked enemy ships and can get more readings about them as well as what their weakness is. And then you have someone who mans the weapons, chooses when to fire the weapons and things of that nature. And you're all working together to essentially run several different missions depending on what you set your server to. So literally it's all these different crew members with their own computer and their own set of navigational screens, while you have an overarching captain or commander who does not have a screen or not have their own computer, but they can have a screen based off a projector and calls out orders.
But do you have to be in the same room to play it? I don't think you do.
You don't necessarily have to be in the same room.
I mean, obviously later. That helps.
Yeah, in one of the later iterations, they added network support. But essentially, the thought behind the game and the premise which they try and encourage from the Artemis site is really playing with people in the same room, because it's more of that experience with others.
Like being on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Exactly.
Yeah, being on the bridge of the original Enterprise. It's basically what it is. You're getting taken into – you're being immersed in what, you know, it is to have the roles of – the traditional roles of Sulu, Chekov, Uhura, and, Spock, obviously Kirk, and you're getting to see that. It's actually laid out a little bit more like the Next Generation, but I feel like the technology they talk about is very original series. For me, I think this brings up a broader conversation. I really feel as if a big part of massively multiplayer games that doesn't appeal to me right now is the lack of true collaboration. Yeah, you know, if you're in a D&D type game, World of Warcraft, whatever, you've got to run up and, you know, there might be a mage versus a fighter versus, you know, some other type of a cleric or whatever, and you guys are going to work together to take down a foe. But I feel like in the realm of science fiction, I look at stuff like EVE Online and look at stuff like the Star Wars Old Republic situation. And I feel like there is the massively multiplayer game that I want to play involves the collaboration of Artemis, that real time in the room collaboration from a virtual level, not being in the same room. Plus the ability to have a campaign in which people have very, very different roles. So you might be a starship captain that is working with your 5, 10, whatever people, and you're trying to get your ship into position above a planet. And then someone else might have logged on, and their role is that space marine, that classic, like, starship trooper. And their job is, you know, your job as a captain, your mission, your whole mission is to get them there and then defend the spot in space or whatever. And then their job is to, like, take whatever objective there is on planet side or whatever. And I feel like that's something that I'm really excited to see. And you look at Artemis and you begin to see the beginning of like truly collaborative, massively multiplayer games where not everyone is just fighting, but there's like a bigger goal and the bigger team has to figure out what to do.
Right. They actually have some of that in some of the newer games like Planet Side 2. You can have roles where people are captains and it's this whole massive, although it's more of a battle, right? But it's still negotiating armies. But, man, Artemis was so much fun. Now, granted, graphically, it's nothing impressive. But just we must have played it for like 7 hours actually on Sunday, just because each game took a long time and you just got lost and immersed.
And everyone
in
gets
it.
A chance, everyone at a different role. And I mean, that's the way. I mean, in some ways, that's the reason why you're playing Artemis in person, because it's like a board game. You're just using a computer.
Right.
That's where that like in the flesh experience really matters, because Artemis is essentially a humongous board game. You're sitting there around with everybody else. You're looking at your screens. You've brought your hardware because you can't rely on one person to have all that stuff. And just like a LAN party of old, you're there. But You got to have the refreshments. You got to have everything else. You got to play it. And I mean, I think that's what's really exciting about it. And what's even more exciting is that this is a game that isn't built by a major studio.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's another one of those indie titles, and it's kind of really cool to see that sort of fruition occur these days. You know, it doesn't have to be this big budget affair to be a quality experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't a small budget, but it's still not the huge situation that, you know, a Halo would be or whatever.
Well, you know? The talk about Artemis segues nicely into the first one of my what I'm playing with, which is Space Team, which is an app for iOS devices, and it's essentially like a really sort of pared down, almost comic version of what you're describing with Artemis, where you get together with a number of other players who all have Space Team installed on their OS devices. And you shout across to them different commands as if you were both team members on a spaceship with a singular goal of flipping these arcane switches in order to keep the ship from blowing up. So you basically you would shout across the room to each other and tell someone to like switch the shift sanitizer to 2 or
so it's like. It's almost like steampunk, like spaceship collaboration.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, it's all analog. You're flipping switches. You're yelling at someone to, like, open some vents so the shit doesn't explode.
Exactly.
You're shaking your phones, flipping them upside down. Yep.
And it's just sort of the comic sort of – it's a comic manic version of Artemis. With a little bit of like Bop It thrown in there for good measure. It's a lot of fun, and I think it's free. So there are upgrades.
Yeah.
You can...
yeah, it is. I just installed it as we talked about it.
Yeah, it's free. It's great. I've enjoyed playing it. I remember when my colleague and I first started playing it, everyone started coming around and me like, hey, we should play this for our team meetings. And I know in our building, the second floor has a scoreboard for Space Teams.
Oh, nice.
Which people have different things on. It's another one of those great games, you know, just like Artemis, where it's good to see the indie developers get something out there. And I believe, is it a maximum of 6 players or 4 players?
I don't know what the limit is, but, you know, when you get to over a certain amount of people, it gets really sort of confusing. So I would imagine that that there would have to be some sort of limit.
Yeah, for Artemis itself, although you have 6 people per ship, you can have several ships. And so what ended up having is we had 2 groups, and people can do more than one role, too. So we had... I think we had 8 people, so mm-hmm. we made 2 ships, or maybe close to 10. We made 2 ships, and we actually used walkie-talkies to communicate between both ships.
Oh, that's awesome.
Different rooms. It was, yeah.
Wow, walkie-talkies.
Yep.
Another thing that I've been playing with is I just bought into a Kickstarter called 3Doodler, and it's they build themselves as the world's first 3D printing pen. And what is it is essentially it's like a heat gun with this that you feed a ABS plastic line through. It heats the plastic line up and ejects the molten plastic, which cools almost immediately as it's being ejected out of the pen, so that you can use it in its like semi-hot cooling mode to sculpt 3D objects in space, like sculpt an object in the middle of sort of in 3D space. So it's kind of like a 3D printer, except you're holding on to the pen and you can draw in space. And it's a fairly simple concept, but it's fairly amazing sort of what you can do with it. And they had a $30,000 goal, and they just hit $1.4 million. And they've still got 31 days to go. So,
how much is it?
It's for the basic unit, it's $75. right now is a early. I think you can go. Yeah, it's $75. You can do $99 for more colors, but the basic unit is $75 pledge.
And give it. What's the name again?
It's called Three Doodler. The letter three and then Doodler. It's by a company called Wobbleworks LLC.
Mm-hmm. And what's the date that it's supposed to be out?
If you pledge now, you can get it as early as December.
Oh wow!
So as yeah, you're gonna be waiting a little bit. But you know, I mean, this to me feels very typical for Kickstarter. Like anything 6 months, and I wouldn't expect anything less than 6 months for most Kickstarters.
Mm-hmm.
Project.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now the one, so I noticed this Kickstarter and I was intrigued by it, but mm-hmm. the one thing that I think so far has kept me back is, you know, I saw some of the designs and it looked like you probably still needed some sort of artistic ability.
Right.
Sure. Well, the other thing you can do is you can use mm-hmm. templates. Like you can have a paper template that you lay flat on the ground. And you essentially trace over the paper template. And then using the extruded plastic from the that you've traced over the paper template with, you can build models from different like sides. You know, you can trace a side of an object using one of these templates, and four sides will put together a three-dimensional object. Like the example that they have here is the Eiffel Tower. They've got the Eiffel Tower drawn out, and you just basically trace over the line and you put those pieces together and you built your own Eiffel Tower.
That sounds pretty exciting. It does. I do think that it sounds like you need some level of skill, like what Tosin says. This
sure.
is for those people who are they're looking for a new way to express themselves. But I do, like, I've been big, I feel like, lately in the whole, in two big things, quantitative self and unleash creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this does both, you know.
Yeah.
I just wish that there was some sort of USB connectivity so that you could have a 3D version of this sitting on some sort of AutoCAD or whatever.
Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I think you can print out 3D. You can print out patterns and then trace over them. But yeah, you're right. There's no sort of, because it's a freehand device. It's not connected to any sort of motors or anything.
Right. What I was interested in this one Kickstarter called Auris. It is a little device that you put on top of your, any dock you have, like any kind of uh-huh. like speaker dock or whatever. And basically, what it is it turns your speaker into Bluetooth, which is the mm-hmm. I think the de facto, especially with Bluetooth 4.0.
I funded that one and got the my device, my Auris device.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they're kind of expensive. They're like $40, I think, if you're gonna get one, and it's kind of, to me, it's a little pricey for what it is, but whatever. I think it's a good deal, and I think that that's one of those Kickstarters that I'm excited that, you know, actually came to fruition.
And the last thing I want to talk about, what I'm playing with this week before we get into we're going to talk about what you've been playing with, Dwayne, but before we get into that, the last thing I want to talk about was, we've talked about on the show before about Black Mirror, which is the Channel 4 series in the UK that was created and written for the most part by Charlie Brooker, who is a writer, a columnist, a commentator on essentially on tech and media. And last year, the three episodes of Black Mirror that were released were just a phenomenon, and they equal. It's an anthology series that deals with the dangers of encroaching technology, and I would say that it's probably the best sort of science fiction anthology series that I've seen since the original Rod Serling Twilight Zone. And the second series of three episodes are starting to air on Channel 4 in the UK again. And I've seen the first two episodes of that series, and they're just once again amazing. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to check this out. Technically, there's no legal way for you to obtain it in the U.S. So you have to kind of
Let's not say that. Let's just say there's no official way to consume the content in the U.S.
Yes, you have to sort of go through back channels, gray areas.
If your friend has a DVR in the U.K. and that DVR happens to be associated with a Sling box, there's no reason why you can't just take a look without, you know, breaking any rules.
Have either of you checked out Black Mirror?
I've checked out the first season. Toasted, it's worth taking a look at. The it does have a very Twilight Zone feeling to it, although it's highly modernized. And I would go far. I wouldn't call it science fiction as much as I would call it social, like social projection or kind of social fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that it is true science fiction. Insofar as when you read something like The Foundation or He, She, and It or any of those things, the things that like really focus on, or The Martian Chronicles, focus on how our society deals with new types of stimulus and new ways of knowing, it hits that. But I think in today's world, when you say science fiction, you think of starships and laser guns. And I think that it's more than that. It's really a question about how where our society could go based on what's available in terms of the way we communicate and how we live. And I feel like it's because of that, it's pretty exciting.
All right, Dwayne, what have you been playing with this week?
I've been playing with some offline shit, guys. mostly, I've been playing with a Leatherman. It's called the Skeletool. I spent the last week in Whistler, Canada, basically snowboarding on Black Home Glacier. And, you know, when you're out there and it's all about your equipment. It's not even your tech. It's just your equipment. Some of your equipment is more technological, like my Bluetooth helmet and shit like that. But I had this device called the Skeletool, which got me out of jam after jam after jam, which is basically like a really hardcore, like kind of it's a Leatherman. Nice. You unfold it. You get your wire clippers and stuff like that. But when you're stuck against a tree, or when you're caught against the line or whatever, you pull out your knife, that kind of thing. So that was kind of exciting, even though it was kind of boring because it's not like electronic. And other than that, I got this. I was on this trip, and we had this problem of we're in this big house, and some people are in the hot tub, and some people are in the main room, and some people are outside in the front doing whatever. So my friend and I had to figure out how to entertain all these people, you know, with media. So we basically scrounged around and got like a whole bunch of different types of speakers. I have a Logitech Bluetooth speaker that mm-hmm. was attached to something, and he managed to find this little tiny Bluetooth capable circular speaker. It's not on Kickstarter, and I can't figure out where he got it, but it's this little thing. It's probably the size of a hockey puck, and the amount of sound this thing makes puts Jambox to shame. Is it as clear and juicy as Jambox? No, but if you're in like the hot tub and you're splashing around anyway, just the tunes coming out of this thing, low powered, it can connect to your phone via the mini jack.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do Bluetooth, and I'm talking like 6-7 hours via the mini jack of like music at a good clip, and
that's impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it was this little tiny thing. It's again, it's not like the crystal clear, super awesome like audiophile stuff you'll get from the Jambox, but it's really got the job done. So, I had my Logitech speaker, which is cool because it has a. It's the Z515. It's got like, you can go Bluetooth, you can go mini jack, or you can pull out the dongle that is nested in the back, pop it into a Windows machine or an OS X machine, and it will automatically, without you having to configure Bluetooth, find the speaker and just output your audio there. So that was helpful. But I mean, like, let's face it, when you're on the go, you're not bringing your laptop to play the music. The only reason you bring that is as a super library, which is what we ended up doing. The laptop holds like 150 gigs of music. So each iOS device could hit that up over the Wi-Fi and just share that music, mm-hmm. disseminate that. So that was kind of exciting. But yeah, so I mean, I haven't been playing with a lot of high-tech stuff, but in terms of just the mundane, surviving on a glacier.
It all counts.
Yeah, messing around with the with that. Oh, there was one thing that I did play with that. It's kind of old school, but I think it's worth mentioning. So for Christmas, I got a camera connection kit from the iPad, and what I found is that, you know, I've been using this ancient Plantronics headset to podcast forever. Uh-huh. And, you know, the more I get into, you know, not having a bulky laptop around me, the more I want to just kind of be free. So I've done the podcast once or twice on an iPad, but today and actually right now, I've been able to use the camera connection kit's USB in to use my USB dongle for my you know, Plantronics headset as a means to connect to the iPad and, you know, communicate with you guys over that. So instead of having to be attached to a laptop or like carry around a laptop, the iPad, high quality sound, it's all there. So that was kind of fun. So if you don't have a camera connection kit, but you do like to record stuff, whether it's, you know, podcasty stuff, or you just have a mic that you use for recording music, singing, playing a guitar, whatever, if you haven't tried the camera connection kit, it works with, I know it works with GarageBand, and it does work with Skype. So there you go.
All right. All right, let's get into some of these headlines here, and we've got a lot of headlines. It's going to be a big show. So last week there was as I'm sure I don't have to tell anybody, everyone pretty much on Earth knew about this. There was a meteor that streaked across the sky in Russia and landed in a small town in remote Russia. And the thing, the meteor itself isn't necessarily something that is sort of tech related or anything that sort of caught my attention. But what really caught my attention, and I wanted to just kind of throw this out there, is that the footage of the meteor was captured by cameras mounted on car dashboards from regular Russian drivers. And it's great footage. The footage that I saw was like largely, you know, high definition 720 or 1080p footage, great footage. And it just got me wondering, what the hell, why do all of these Russians have dash cams on their car dashboards? I didn't understand it. So I did a little investigation, a little looking up, and apparently like insurance fraud is a big problem in Russia, especially.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, Russians are like widely considered the most, like, if there's a scam in Europe, it like, I don't know, the United Nations procurement scam of 2006, that was like all Russians. They're like, no offense to the Russians out there, but, you know, they've unfortunately, you know, some rotten apples have spoiled the barrel in terms of the reputation when it comes to scam and fraud and so on.
Yeah. These Russian drivers are all putting dash cams on their dashboards in order to to witness hit and runs, because it's very common over there, and it's the only way that they can sort of substantiate their claims in court. So I just thought it was fascinating that you have this sort of situation that that requires this ubiquitous video presence from all the drivers in one particular area. And it's something that seems to be indigenous to Russia. And it made me wonder, I wonder how long it is until it's that way over here in the U.S.
Well, it's a voluntary big brother, which is what's so interesting.
Yeah.
The people are volunteering to share that information themselves. It's kind of like what, you know, could happen with a like 10th generation extension of Google Glass, right?
Just
recording everything.
We'll get to that in a minute too, because I want to get into that when we get into the Google Glass stuff. But yeah, that's absolutely, you're absolutely right.
It's an interesting thing that people want to police themselves. There's so much dishonesty out there that the question is, can we record everything so we can get rid of some of that dishonesty? What's funny is that if you talk to historians about the capturing, the study of how we actually like capture history, it's called historiography. Mm-hmm. What's interesting with them is that the video, regardless of like having video there for the average person, for you, for me, anyone, like, oh, there's a video, we know what happened. But for insurance companies, for historiographers, whatever, it's not enough still, you know, depending on the angle and who was shooting it and what were they trying to capture and what were they trying to hide and all these things. So there's kind of a never-ending story of what the truth is. And it's interesting that the Russians, in this case, in this small town, and, you know, the town did suffer some casualties. I think 127 people were injured because glass exploded. I mean, like, the details of this particular impact of the meteor were, you know, it was, I think, something like a kiloton or something like that in terms of the size of the impact. So it was a very substantial impact. We haven't seen that in 100 years since the last time a meteor, oddly enough, hit Russia. So it's interesting to see the thing that, you know, luckily they have the biggest country in the world. Right. So it's probably likely that something would hit their country. But, you know, luckily very few people were hurt, and I'm glad for that. But it's interesting that the way this was captured was because of this sort of capitalist need to make sure that if something should happen to my property, I need the insurance company that I employ or pay premiums to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, you know. We captured.
It is also pretty sad because I was watching some of the traffic videos, and this is kind of like footage which you just couldn't even look away from people who are just doing crazy things, getting into accidents, and then just kind of like leaving their cars there and walking away. And it was just like something shocking.
So were they hoping that their cars would get destroyed too?
Well, they were just hoping. So these are people who were in the accident. So who it was their fault, and they were like, my car is probably old enough that I don't really need it anymore, and I don't want to be caught by this other person. And they grab their stuff and start walking away. And you're just like, did that actually just happen? Did someone just leave their car? So I really hope we don't get to that point in the U.S. where, you know, hit and runs are a commonplace that we have to put dashboard cams in. But I will say it is pretty cool that we had all these cams and have all these angles about the to be able to check the footage.
Well, I mean, we're already doing a crowd-focused reporting of where we are in order to get something out of it.
Yeah.
That's what the app Waze is, another app we use on the trip.
Oh, right.
Where what basically happens is you take the Google Maps idea of every time someone's connected to Google Maps, they're passing their GPS data back to a Google Maps server in order for Google to understand how quickly they're driving on a road that should be 50 miles an hour. If they're driving at 50 or 60 miles an hour, everyone sees traffic as green. If people over there are driving at 20 miles an hour, the traffic is red. At 40 miles an hour, it's yellow, that sort of thing. That passes back to everybody. Waze is an extension of that, not made by a giant corporation like Google, but made by a much smaller organization where, you know, it's completely social insofar as you can actually look up the people that you know. Are they on the road as well? And you can also – and it's a natural extension of that. So we're using this ability to record our actions in order to get something out of it. And with Waze, the big deal is that, okay, I found an alternative route to get from A to B because, you know, route A had a big traffic jam or there was an accident or something. And I'm sharing that with everybody else, and I'm giving them my data in order for them to be able to understand, like, you know, how best to get to where they want to go. So we're already taking what is sensitive data, location data, and passing along to our you know, fellow people, or just keeping it out there in order to get something out of it. And it's interesting that the Russians are doing the same thing, albeit for a more direct financial monetary gain, but hey, whatever captures the situation. Waze is you know, it's slated to be used in local broadcasts about traffic now. So that gives you an idea of how powerful it is. To, you know, the Russians are capturing this like massive event that's happening in the world, and on a local level, you know, local newscasters and the traffic guys are going to be using things like Waze to capture events that are happening in their local world. So, you know, the world is not too different.
The article that I read did say that since the age of the dash cam, the hit and run hustle has withered from a flourishing enterprise to a dying trade. So, you know, it's a preventative measure to have those dash cams on your dashboard, I guess, at this point. Okay, so let's move on here. Apple has a team of about 100 product designers working on a wristwatch-like device that may perform some of the tasks now handled by the iPhone and iPad, people familiar with company plans said. The team includes managers marketers, software, hardware engineers that previously worked on the iPhone and iPad, and a patent discovered by Apple Insider on Thursday reveals that the Apple is indeed investigating a wearable accessory device that not only boasts a full-length flexible touchscreen display, but conforms to a user's body through the use of a slap bracelet-like mechanism. When active, it will connect to a portable unit via Bluetooth or Wi-Fi and show relevant information in real time. While the device can conform to nearly any appendage, the suitable location would be on a user's wrist. So did Apple sort of see the pebble and start scrambling towards doing something like this, or is this just kind of the zeitgeist of
I'm going to say this. I'm not going to go accusing a company of copying another company, but I will say that I look at the iPad Mini, the device that Steve Jobs said would never happen, and I think all of us are immediately reminded of the success of the Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire.
Right.
I'm reminded even more of the Porsche Cayman. It's a Porsche. It's a sports car. Porsche makes a car called the Boxster, which is a small car. You can get it for around $60,000. And they make the Carrera, which is their big supercar, rear engine vehicle, which is in excess of hundreds of thousands of dollars if you want to get one all set up. What Porsche did was they created the Cayman, which sits in the middle price wise. They weren't really solving a problem in terms of what sort of car they knew people wanted. They were solving a problem in terms of what sort of device they think they can garner a market for, because their competitors had a car that was sitting at the Cayman's price that was relatively performance-driven. And they were like, well, there are people who would buy it because it has the Porsche name. Now, I look at it again, the iPad Mini. I look at this device that people have seen that other guys had that, worked really, really well. And Apple saying, possibly, there's a market for this. Can we offer something for this market? And then the answer is yes. There's a market for the watch. Pebble showed us that even before the device could be in the hands of anyone, there was an incredible demand for this. So if you're a person at Apple and you're working on their product strategy, the ability to say we can do this better, we can do a touchscreen, we can do whatever, that's not outside of the realm of possibility. Then again, we are in this age, like I said, of quantitative self, where we've got the Fitbit, where we've got the Nike Fuel Band. We've got the Jawbone up. So there's a trend just in the space to have a way to quantify your movement with a device that's a little bit more designed to be sculpted around your body than a telephone would be. So, there is some of that. There is some of this idea that there's a trend here. In the days of old, perhaps Apple would have introduced this device a long time before anybody else did. But, the company is much bigger. They've got a lot of, fish to fry, and maybe they haven't. So it's unclear whether or not this is just a trend in tech or if Apple is trying to chase a market. But either way, I think that we can all agree that there's a certain it's not the wow factor that we all had in late 2009 when we knew that there may be a tablet coming out from Apple that would change the way things work. This idea of the watch, while it's a new product, since people have come to market before them, we're not as wowed by the very concept of it. In fact, we're sort of like, okay, I guess they'll get to it one day. So, I mean,
what I will say is I personally don't believe that it is a reaction. I think the watch has been something which they've actually been working on for a long, long time. It's just that each time they've gotten to a certain stage, they've just kind of shut down production and haven't put as much input. And you can probably see a lot more information about that on the web, just for early ideas on a wearable watch in, early 2000s and beyond.
So you've researched this and you found that there was talk about an Apple Watch around the time of the iPod Genesis.
Yeah, actually much early on. Now, it wasn't anything that at least – I think there's several courses which have changed. Now, like anything that Apple does instantly makes headlines. Yeah. So we're in a whole different mindset that they can no longer keep secrets.
Yeah, they release patents all the time, by the way. I mean, not release, but they have patents issued for them all the time, which, you know, often end up nowhere. It's just that you have to, when you have an idea, you patent it because it doesn't cost very much and
exactly,
you know, you get money for it.
I do think the difference this time around is the amount of effort they're pushing into it. I think it was one of those nice to haves. Same thing with, like, you know, how we've heard that Steve Jobs would always wanted a car, you know, sort of a nice to have. Maybe there was a little bit of a drive into it, but not I didn't even mean to do that, but not a full blown effort towards it. And at least from what we're hearing right now, it sounds like it's, you know, it's go get them.
They've got 100 people on staff.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's a large company that has the resources to put 100 people on staff, but it does somewhat remind me of the reports I heard out of Google when Plus was being launched that everything was for Plus. Get the best talent. Get whatever you have to get. Mm-hmm. Make Plus happen. So, I mean, it's interesting to me to see that they're going in this direction when I look at – I mean, and Andy said we'll talk about it later, but, I mean, let's go back to it. The Google Glass, which is an idea that I think is a bit of a leap from the current wearable world, the wristwatch, the thing in your pocket, the band. It's the leap in terms of allowing interactivity to happen right before your face, a kind of step toward virtual reality, this augmented reality that does in some ways allow for the quantitative self. So it's interesting that they're being a bit more, for lack of a better term, conservative when it comes to this sort of device instead of just kind of coming out and doing something that's breakthrough in terms of the way we look at things. So there is that.
All right, let's move on here. Yahoo began...
Well, I will say one thing about the watch. If the watch can be protected in the same way an iPhone case protects an iPhone, it's going to be a big thing for sports people. If you're doing any kind of extreme sport, skiing, snowboarding, dirt biking, mountain biking, cycling, road biking, windsurfing, any of that stuff, where that the quantitative stuff would really be helpful. But frankly, it's really rough. You're being fueled by gasoline or by gravity or by wind, and it's just you. There's not a big car around you or anything to protect you. This kind of device, if it can be protected, would be relatively hardy and allow you to maintain the movement of whatever vehicle you're controlling and take a glance at your watch and see what's up. Right now, if you're skiing, when you get down to the lift, that's when you see what time it is, unless you like take the time to stop and pull out your phone or something like that. Yeah, being able to run the types of apps that would be helpful for those kinds of users, those kinds of users that require like gasoline or gravity or wind or whatever in order to move forward, that would be an interesting thing. I think that's something that I would definitely look into. I mean, granted, I look into everything, but that's something that I think that regime, that sports happy regime of tech people would be into.
Well, I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit more about this also when we get into the Google Glass thing. But before we do, Yahoo began rolling out a redesigned homepage this week as part of CEO Mercer Mayer's ongoing effort to revive the once-proud web company. The once-cluttered landing page has now been replaced with a notably more streamlined layout that allocates primary real estate to Yahoo's most recognizable properties, including email, news, Yahoo Finance, and Yahoo Sports. They've also added a Twitter-like stream, an infinite news scroll, and social features that allow users to see content recommended by Facebook friends. And they've adapted similar features on its mobile and tablet apps as well. I've seen this. I've played with it. I think it's a good direction, but is it enough to keep Yahoo afloat?
Hard to say. It still seems way too busy. I like that it's cleaner, but I want something which is more lightweight. And I don't know if that's even possible on like a hardy site like Yahoo. You know, similarly, like CNN is quite busy for what it is. But I don't know. In this day and age, it seems like they've got something that maybe still a couple years back. And I want something a bit more progressive and more adventurous. If you're coming in from behind the races, you need to be more aggressive and more entrepreneurial, or that's the wrong word, more evocative of something new and unique.
Yeah, well, you have to want to try to break the mold. You have to go against the grain.
Exactly.
If you're coming from behind, everyone is trying to do something.
Right.
And you've got to, you know, garner an audience or just surprise and delight or whatever. I mean, Google does this from time to time when they have a new feature. They're like, hey, you want to test out this new feature we're doing? And you click on it and suddenly, like, your email is not the whole page anymore. It's just this thing on the lower right-hand corner. And it's crazy.
But all those companies have less to lose than Yahoo.
I think that's the opposite. I think they have more to use by alienating people. Yahoo's already alienated enough people. It can only, you know, I think that it's really a question of Yahoo does – it's in a position where it has less to lose. It doesn't have a lot of people. It's already, like, kind of sunken. Mm. And it's basically sort of like, well, what have we got to lose? We just have to, like, make things better, make things bigger, be bold. Because if we don't, we'll just suffer from atrophy until we're gone. So, you know.
Okay, let's move on here. Bungie has unveiled a new video game, or at least they've unveiled sort of like the working sort of plans for one. The game has no release date yet. It's called Destiny, and it's a shared world shooter, according to Activision Publishing CEO Eric Hirschberg, with a multiplayer that has been described as similar to the innovative Journey, which was a great game, and its equally innovative sort of matchmaking system. So far, with their unveil, screenshots and gameplay video remain sparse, and the game is very much in the concept art phase. It'll have a little bit of something for everyone. You can go solo or stick with a group. There's going to be some sort of large group raid system as well. There's a few videos online, a couple of videos online from Bungie, sort of highlighting what they've got so far. A lot of concept art. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is one of the developers said that in developing this new game, they needed something with enough ideas to last us for the next 10 years. And I was trying to sort of parse what he meant by that. And I'm trying to figure out, does that mean that the one game is going to be able to be played for like 10 years straight? Or is he talking in reference to, say, the Halo series, where we've had a full 10 years of different iterations of the Halo world?
Well, I don't know. I think you'd have to... I don't know if it's either. You can. There's also the World of Warcraft model.
Mm-hmm.
Warcraft 3 came out in 2002. I think World of Warcraft came out in, 2005? And I think it's kind of just sat there. And while the engine has been upgraded modestly over the years, you've been essentially playing the same game with new content, new downloadable, purchasable content,
right,
for a long, long time. And I can see a game company saying, that's a model that we want to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys take a look at this, the artwork from Destiny?
It's pretty.
Yeah.
Bungie is one of those companies I kind of trust, but it's still, I need some more substance.
It kind of reminds me of
I don't PlayStation. Like these announcements. Yeah.
It's early days. Like that,
Andy, you're going to hate me. Remember when Google Glass first came out, I was like, these damned pre-announcements, show me something real.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they're doing for these their investors with the concept art and the talking about specs, and maybe with the PlayStation 4, they're talking about specs and hoping to get some feedback from people, and then they could spec it up even more and, you know, make people impressed later or some shit. But
that's a good question. Why release anything? Yeah, why announce anything this early?
The obvious reason, and DaVinci would back me up on this, is you got to get attention for your brand when stuff's happening. The PS4 announcement just happened. There's all this stuff about the Xbox 3. Bungie's like, hey, I can jump in here with some new stuff for whatever I want to do. But the problem is, as a conscientious consumer, as a knowledgeable consumer, I'm really kind of focused on, you know, where can I, like, if I'm going to put my money down, you know, where can I put it? Where should I be thinking about, you know, putting my money down? Especially in a time where, you know, people do have to save for devices and for games and whatever. You know, people have to think about their purchases more. Like, give me a reason to purchase. Give me a reason to think about you in a legitimate and respectful financial way. Because Otherwise, I'm going to go with what's available right now, you know, because a lot of this stuff is annoying.
Yeah, there's like, a lot of these early announcements, and I think that's one of the areas that Apple does best is they announce they have something and they release pretty close to when they announce.
Within a month or two, usually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least it isn't even like it doesn't actually fully matter when the release date is, as long as it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
This,
mm-hmm.
you know, if PlayStation wanted to say, this is our console, we don't have the chassis for it,
right.
but we have all the data for it, and it will be released for Christmas 2013, we'd all be much happier. But instead, we get these wishy-washy things. But we'll talk about that later.
Okay, so moving on, an extremely reliable source has confirmed that Google is in the process of building standalone retail stores in the U.S. and hopes to have the first flagship Google store open for the holidays in major metropolitan areas. The mission of the stores is to get new Google Nexus, Chrome, and other upcoming products in the hands of prospective customers. Google feels that many potential customers will need to get hands-on experience with products before they're willing to purchase. Now, this announcement occurred before the next two items that we have to talk about, and people were like, well, what is it exactly is Google trying to push, get into the hands of people, and won't these stores feel too much like duplicates of the Apple Store, much as some of the early Microsoft stores felt like?
The early Microsoft stores, I will tell you right now, I drove from Vancouver to Seattle before I came back to Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to Seattle, my friends and I had a little extra time. We thought we'd go to one of the malls. And we did, because one friend had to go see some other people's babies and wanted to buy some stuff. We walked into that space, that space that we've all read about, where on one side of the street is an Apple store,
uh-huh.
clad in silver, large silver panes with an Apple logo. And across the street was the Windows store, clad in large white panes with a Windows logo.
Uh-huh.
The wood, the light kind of honey-colored, stained wood on the floor was the same. The mm-hmm. devices were laid out the same, touch it, play with it, whatever. The people who worked at the Windows store all wore shirts of the same color with a lanyard around their neck and an ID badge with some sort of, possible RF whatever in it. And you look out the glass that is the lower part of the front wall of each of these stores and you see the other one. You look around the inside of the store, it's either images or a screen.
Uh-huh.
There's a genius bar, so to speak, at the back, back of the Windows car. And I would think that Google, understanding this situation...
Right.
would hopefully find a way to not...
To differentiate themselves.
To differentiate. Because what Microsoft did was they hurt their own brand when they laid that out.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are people who are hardcore Windows people. They're not going to change whatever. But, I mean, Apple being first to market, back in 2005 or 6 when they opened the first Apple stores,
mm-hmm.
Laying out this experience, Steve Ballmer... should feel somewhat embarrassed about the there's other ways to do a store.
Yeah.
And I think if there's any company that's shown that they're interested in doing things differently, hey, we're going to release an operating system that's based on a web browser. What? Hey, we're going to release, we're a search company that's releasing a phone operating system. What? Google's always been sort of, I'm releasing something different.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to be something different. And I think that they have the capacity to do that. I trust there. Whereas, I mean, we've been charting Microsoft's situation for quite some time, and this situation was bad. I mean, this was just last weekend I was there.
I will say, like the Microsoft store which I went to in Palo Alto, although there were a lot of similarities, there was some pretty cool stuff too. Like the entire walls, surrounding walls, were all screens.
It's a screen, and big screen, yeah.
It was several actually. There were some big ones, but several little ones, so you could pick up a controller and start playing on a screen as a sidewall. So it was actually kind of interesting, and I know they've really started pushing, doing more stuff in the community. Like if they had signs up about, if you want to get together and try and set up like a 360 LAN party, they could potentially host it for free, that sort of stuff.
Oh, nice.
But there were a lot of similarities. I do agree there too. It would be cool to see Google differentiate itself in terms of a store, but I think we all saw a store coming. Like,
yeah,
it's to be expected that they join the other big two.
It kind of makes sense with the stuff that they've got upcoming that they've announced, the products that they've got upcoming they announced, and that first of which, the one was announced today, which was the Chromebook Pixel, which is the latest sort of netbook, Chrome based netbook. It's got a 12.85-inch high density 2560 by 1700 pixel screen, 4.3 million pixels with a 3.2 aspect ratio, which is strange because most laptops nowadays are 16 by 9 or some sort of like widescreen variation. But their justification for that was that since most people will be doing on the Chromebook is still net browsing, web pages are still sort of oriented in either square or vertical.
Can I just say amen to that? Because yeah. This whole widescreen laptop thing, mm-hmm. I don't buy a laptop to watch a movie. I'm sorry, I don't. And when I open up web pages, and the only advantage of it is if I have to do some work and I need to have, you know, I need to have something snapped to one side and snapped to another side, maybe I can do that. But when I'm just reading, it's the portrait layout that matters to me most. In fact, mm-hmm. that portrait layout is one of the reasons that the reading is one of the reasons why I own a white iPad instead of a black one, because the transition from a white page, a white web page,
right,
to the white iPad when I'm holding it in portrait is much better than the harsh cutoff of black. We still read things. And when I look at my...
Like, I don't read anymore.
All right. Well, that's you. But one of the things that I do, like I did get a 19... I got a my monitor, my external monitor at home, one of them is 1920 by 1200. And that extra, you know, 120 pixels or whatever makes the reading that much better than when I'm on a 1920 by 1080 monitor. Because it does matter. And I'm glad that they are thinking about that. And frankly... You know, the Chromebook is focused on the web, on being on the web. And, yeah. You know, for the most part, you're not watching on the web.
Yeah, I had an interesting discussion with friends about this announcement. And I think the general gist, the general conclusion that we all came to is that it just seems really expensive for what it is. One of my friend's original complaints was, you know, he had one of the earlier Chromebooks, and one of the issues that they had is it was a good device, but he couldn't install Skype on it because, of course, everything was more cloud-based,
right.
Cloud-oriented.
Right. They want you to use Google Hangouts.
Right, and because he couldn't...
Which is no Skype.
Yep. Because he couldn't install Skype, it kind of made it worthless. And although I see a lot of awesome things you can do with the cloud, so mm-hmm. my exact perception of where this is right now is I'm a little unsure because that price tag is just so high.
Yeah.
For what
yeah,
you're
I mean,
getting.
What is it? It's $1,300 for a 32 gigabyte version.
Yeah.
It's $1,450 for a 62 gigabyte version. That is with the Verizon LTE. So basically, you're getting that kind of $150. That on an Apple product, you'd spend. On an iOS product, you spend $100 just for the space, and then another $130 for the you know GPS cellular mm-hmm. whatever. This one, you're spending $150 to get them both, to get yep. double the space basically, and then the cellular modem. So there is that.
And they're also backing up their whole like cloud storage dynamic by offering you a terabyte of free storage on Google Drive for 3 years.
Yep. Now the question is, what happens after those 3 years?
Yeah.
So that's the big thing for me. I will say, did you watch the commercial for this or the their ad for it?
Mm-hmm. No.
It's totally speaking of ripping off. It's totally just an Apple ad. That's really what it
so
is.
Did you notice that there was the one guy who was like in the Johnny Ive sort of role talking about the design of the device, and he's like yep. doing that sort of off center.
You should link the commercial to the show notes for this.
I will, for sure. Yeah. Speaking of other Google product announcements, the latest marketing video for Project Glass, Google's ambitious wearable display, finally shows off its awesome potential. Now, Glass doesn't look like just like a casual device for annoying hipsters. It looks like something essential for sharing intimate and exciting moments in your life. They're also opening up
pre-order. Who wrote that?
That was our own Devendra Hardawar.
He wrote that it looks like something essential for sharing moments of your life.
Yes.
I think the word essential is a bit strong on the lingo there, Dev.
So, Google is also opening up pre-orders for Project Glass in the form of a contest. Post a note to Twitter or Google Plus with the hashtag #IfIHadGlass in 50 words or less detailing what you do with a glass headset. It's still going to cost you $1,500, but it just gets you higher on the pre-order list. Now, I have to admit that when I saw this, after I saw this video, I very nearly wept, and I couldn't.
What?
Yes, and I couldn't.
Wow.
I couldn't at first explain the sudden rush of emotions or why this video struck me at such a visceral level. And then thinking about it, I broke it down to two things. First of all, we truly are living in the future after seeing this. And secondly, where it may not have been clear in earlier Glass footage, here I can clearly see, no pun intended, how this device can fundamentally enhance our lives on a daily basis. It's a truly transformative device.
You're saying that you now understand the use case for this device.
Absolutely. Well, they've very clearly illustrated all the different sort of use cases for it, and where you might use it in different places to, you know, instantly defining an object by asking Glass to tell you what the object is, or calling up a picture and then using that picture as reference for something you're doing in real life, like painting or sculpting.
Okay, I want to stop you right there just for a moment. And I want to say that the thing about this is that I'm going to pull you back into the present.
Okay.
You say we're living in the future.
Okay.
And I think that if this device can do what we see, then yeah, that's going to be the moment. But until you see that on someone's face, this video is a highly produced movie. It's a not even a commercial. It's like a small feature film. It's what you'd see at the beginning of a Pixar film. And I think it's really important that we remember that. The footage that we're seeing could be from a GoPro, could be from a Contour, could be from anything. Google's putting it together. No, really. Google's putting it together to show us. And again, this is a concept video.
Well, but I feel like
show
this
us
is...
What's, wait, hold on. It's putting it together to show us what's possible. And I think that's fine. It's not my cup of tea. I've always been against concept videos. But I think that's fine. But we're not in the future. And I've communicated with people at Google. And the device is not – this is not the device yet, right? These are still things – the good news here is that Google is focused on this and they're going to move it forward. It's not some concept video that has kind of fallen into the night like those crazy Microsoft supercard things that were supposed to be in the future. It's not going to fade away into the night. They're focused on it. There's attention here. They want to get this done. They want to do it. So there's people working on it, and we can see something happening. Now, is there anything substantial and real to show you that this is actually what the device is going to be able to do, or that the device can do this efficiently, this instantly, this whatever? Anytime you see a prototype and it works this smoothly, it's suspect. We've seen that even in CES when running stuff off. You know, they were running a video where they said they were doing real-time rendering.
We've seen that in Apple commercials.
We've seen that in Apple commercials. Everything's simulated. And, you know, I haven't seen the little text that says, you know, simulated or whatever in this particular video. But I really feel like as geeks, I'm happy to get excited about the possibility of this product.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really not there, and it really is vaporware, like that Phantom game console from back in the day. Until we can see it on someone's face, on a stage, you know, with some sort of like Wi-Fi enabled
viewing. I've seen it on Sergey Brin's face.
I don't know. I see.
Yeah, but you haven't seen it. You haven't seen it like straight up in there with some sort of like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth enabled. Like, here's the main screen. Here's me touching it. Here's it doing what it's supposed to do for all of you to see. The scientific principles that we live by show that the thing should be measurable, reproducible, and in front of us. And I really, like, when it comes to these concept videos, I really have to put that in front of you. We cannot get ahead of ourselves. Because what happens then is that the device comes out, you spend X amount of thousands of dollars on it, and you're like, oh, shit.
Right. You buy, that's exactly what's that, what's what that maxim? Like, you buy the device that, you don't buy the, you, you go ahead. Because you know better than I do.
You buy the device. You know, the device you buy should do everything exactly as you want it to do right then, and you can't expect it to do any more later. Yeah.
You don't want the, right? You don't buy the device that you hope it'll be. You buy the device that it is now.
Exactly. And right now, it just isn't. It's vaporware just like Apple's Watch. They just have a lot of videos showing what is possible.
I don't necessarily, you know, I actually have some faith here. And I think it's primarily just
that's
from...
where you're not going to convince me of anything. You have faith. I don't faith. I want data.
I think primarily it's because... so before their announcement here, Google had a couple competitions, which they had one in New York. They had one in San Francisco, and there may be another one in a various location. And these were for some of the people who had pre-registered at Google I.O. So they had groups of – I think it was 300 at least, in the at least in the one in San Francisco. And people got to use the Google Glasses for 2 days and also build their own – put together projects. It was basically a hackathon, a two-day hackathon. For you, for people. So I actually and they finally released some of the information.
Did you see the agreement they had to sign before they got their hands on Google Glass?
The NDA is ridiculous. But
exactly. I will say
you have seen it in real life on like normal people. My friend, one of my friends was a participant. And his Facebook photo is him in Google Glasses. He also, by the way,
Did you see it in front of him? I'm saying, you gotta just because there's a picture on Facebook, just because like you got that happy moment, whatever. It's still, guys, it's got to be in that. And I'm gonna hold it to the Apple standard. It's got to be right there on that stage. And afterwards, everyone's got to be able to go to some room where they can pick it up and fuck with it and see how they can break it.
That is true. And that's the standard. I'm not sure how. Standard. Like, I don't exactly know how it would perform on. You know, on a roller coaster, like those are the standards, which I understand. But I think as a wearable device, from you know, just having conversations about what it was like.
This is all soft stuff, man. This is all stuff. I'm just saying, if we hold them to the highest standard, we can expect the best product. If you're going to talk about this mushy stuff with. Oh, I have a friend and he put a picture on Facebook and I've had conversations with people and all that. I mean, these people obviously want it to work. So they're going to speak about it nicely. They obviously like are, you know, there's also the access problem of Google gave it to me and I signed this NDA and I want more access to Google stuff. So am I going to disparage it? No. There's all that. And I'm not trying to say that Google's going to screw up here. I don't want them to. I don't whatever. But concept videos are concepts. Execution is execution. We've seen companies pull off amazing things with execution, and until you are standing there and touching that thing or looking at it on stage with a live demo for everybody to see, and they are taking it off their face, they're showing you what's up, they're giving you an underlying understanding about the principles of how the glass is working, which we still don't have. Is there a thermometer in it, or is it getting that temperature gauge from connecting to the internet? That kind of thing. You know, like what are we seeing in terms of the specifications and all that other stuff? That's when... Obviously, specs are you know, in this day and age with mobile stuff, they're kind of secondary when it comes to something like phones that we're all familiar with. It's just how it works. But when it comes to a brand new concept of a brand new way of knowing, when the first Android phones were coming out, or the when the iPhone first came out, understanding that it had like an edge radio in it was something that Apple put up there. They put up there the 2G, and then they put up there the 3G, and all those relevant speeds and all those other stuff like that. That's the standard that we have to live up to. And I really don't want people to get excited about a device that is vaporware. And I really hope it's not. And I don't think Google's going to like let us down. But I do think that we should, you know, I don't want anyone
to temper
kind of
our expectations.
Like, right. Yeah, like I don't want anyone like you have power, Tosin, and so do you, Andy. And when you say things like it made me tear up, or I've had conversations, or my friend put it on their Facebook wall, I think it's going to present a false hope and like a certain level of expectation that is irresponsible for people in our position to lay out.
I don't know about that. Isn't that part of the human spirit to have hope?
No, I'm not about optimism that way. I'm serious, guys. People are going to make financial decisions based on the stuff you say. Okay, people are going to. You know, I think if we hold Google to the highest standard, I'll say it again. If we hold Google to the highest standard, if the community does that, we'll end up with the best product out there. There are like several devices that are used in bulky devices, which are used in sports that like are augmented reality, that are you know, video on demand. And I feel like a lot of people who are like us, they don't spend a lot of time in sports. So when you look at certain things like Mod and Mod Live, Android ski goggles, which are like the epitome of augmented reality right now when it comes to like riding, or you look at sort of like the Wild Soon stuff, which is like performance eyewear focused on, you know, the guys who are mountain biking or whatever, that kind of shit. You begin to understand like what the true logistics of this stuff are and where it is limited and where it's not limited. So when you see the concept videos of Google Glass, you're like, wow, if they can get us there, that'd be great. But we're really, really far away from there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the biggest thing, the Mod in My Life, that is on Google technology. That is on Android based.
Hmm. Okay, let's assume now that let's extrapolate into the future. And let's assume that we're living in a future where we have always on POV video, okay, whether it be Google or someone else. It's going to happen one way or the other.
So, Looksee already has it. Looksee, there's a Looksee device that you can buy today for $160, and it has always on POV video.
Sure, but it's not ubiquitous. So what I'm talking about is a future where it is ubiquitous, where everyone has one of these devices. Let me ask you a question here. Does that ubiquity necessitate, is it going to necessitate a change to our laws? Will these devices facilitate stalking? What about, let me throw a hypothetical sort of situation here. There was a time when you could go to a concert and you couldn't bring a camera with you because there was no recording allowed during the concert. And they would confiscate cameras. But since the advent of cell phones, they can't take everybody's cell phone away. So it's basically that rule has just knuckled under. And anyone, all the concerts I go to nowadays, you can record, take pictures, whatever. That rule has been nullified because of the ubiquity of cell phone cameras. So what about situations like movies and
courtrooms? Well, Google's already come out and said that there's no such thing as privacy. Right?
Yeah.
Google... You know, they've already said that. And the fact is, privacy is a pretty manufactured situation, just like kind of the love marriage situation or whatever. It's part of the American understanding. They're going to have to, you know, whether it's Google, whether it's Looksee, whether it's Contour,
mm-hmm.
the social mores surrounding the use of always-on POV video, POV being point of view, are going to have to happen. I think we, the people, will be working in concert or against the companies that want to deliver this sort of functionality to everybody. Let's just think about it from the perspective of the data that we already have. Facebook, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg has said he thinks the default is social.
Right.
I think by all understanding, we would look at Mark Zuckerberg and say that he's a visionary. He saw something that other people didn't see, despite a wonderfully simple concept that he was able to bring to execution. Again, there's the key. He brought the concept to execution. And his concept was one that people's social mores did not necessarily tie with, but over time, through, you know, smart individuals working with him to, you know, temper things, through some stumbles when it came to how we deal with privacy, from all these different like trial and error situations, we've come to a place where we went from, I remember 2006, people were like, oh, I can't stand this newsfeed thing, it's so stalkerish, to people only using the newsfeed on their Facebook instances. So will this always on POV video situation be a disruptor for the way that we live our lives? I think in an urban setting, possibly. There may be a time in the far, far future where it's a necessity. We have contact lenses that are always on POV video and it's necessary. I mean, you guys have both possibly seen that TV show that came out from Canada last year.
Right.
Where the woman had the built-in always on POV. She was an officer of the law, and because of that, that was just part of her situation. Continuum, it's called. But what I'm saying is that when this stuff comes out, first of all, the idea of always on POV video represents some physics challenges for us too. I mean, like, if it's always on and always recording, where is it storing it? Is it transmitting all the time? How do the batteries last? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in the far future, where this is a possibility, I see that people who enjoy recording and sharing experiences, who enjoy interacting with one another, would allow this to become a social norm. Maybe there'll be a situation where it's GPS limited, just like when you're in your if you're in like a Nissan sports car and you're in the streets of Japan, there's a governor that kicks in, and so you get onto a racetrack. Then the governor turns off because the GPS knows where you are and that it's okay for you to drive faster than the speed limit. Perhaps you walk into your gym and the recording actually turns off because it's a private place, people are half naked and whatever, whatever, whatever. Who knows? But I don't think it's something – I think that's something that we'll be able to deal with in stride. It'll be a little disruptive, but we'll figure it out just like we have with every other innovation. I mean, there was a time when all transportation on ground was with horses.
Right, right. So lastly, before we get into our break here and get into our main topic here, I just wanted to say that, you know, how ugly that sort of initial model of the Google Glass is that we've seen – looking something like a Borg headset. Apparently, Google's aware of that, and they're going to be working with they're negotiating with Warby Parker, an e-commerce startup company that sells trendy eyeglasses to help it design more fashionable frames, according to people who.
I mean, they used it in. I think it was on a runway, a fashion runway. They were able to use the current incarnation of the glass device on the fashion runway. Which was kind of interesting, especially because, like, in haute couture fashion, the kind of stuff that you see walking down the runway, it's ugly is beautiful, beautiful is what you make it kind of thing. So it's interesting to see that. I'm glad they're working with the designer. I mean, they're coming out early doing this. Remember with Android, their design situation was really nebulous until they got the one guy to bring soul, as they said, to the Android platform. You know,
I think
focusing on design is something that Google's always been challenged with. So it's nice to see that they're starting early.
Yep. I think they've learned their lesson from both Android and sort of the revamp of apps like Google Plus and other sort of their other iOS apps and Android apps. Okay, so let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week I want to recommend Guns, an essay by Stephen King. Now, this was started off as a Kindle ebook, and it's recently been narrated to an audiobook. And essentially this is Stephen King's pulled no punches essay about gun violence in America, in the wake of shootings at Sandy Hook and of course Columbine, he delivers this this essay on. It starts off. It's interesting. I've heard this essay, and it starts off with sort of like measured and composed, and he lays out some facts, and then he sort of slowly builds to sort of like the Stephen King frenetic sort of energy that you expect. And it becomes more of a polemic towards the end of the essay. But I think it's an interesting perspective on gun violence in a way that only Stephen King can deliver. So and earnings from the sale of the essay will go to the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. And I think it's even less than a dollar. So even if you don't use your Audible credit or if you don't choose this as your free audiobook, it's still like less than a buck to download this. And to download that free audiobook or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles, I'm sorry, 100,000 plus titles, is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And a free 30-day trial will give you a chance to check out their service. All right. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Tesla and the New York Times drive each other crazy. But who's right? So take a listen to this and come on back.
Yeah, he's coming for you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuwakin. And last week, New York Times reporter John Broder took a test drive in Tesla's high-performance Model S sedan along the newly electrified stretch of I-95 between New York and Boston. He claims to have followed all of Tesla's range maximization guidelines. The short version is that it did not get the mileage expected, and at one point, a flatbed truck needed to come pick up the totally dead car. Upon publication, Tesla's famous CEO Elon Musk began tweeting up a storm about how the article was, quote, fake, and that he had the vehicle logs to prove it. Then Musk published a blog post with a graphical representation of the log data they had, in which he argues that Broder lied and even purposely tried to run the car out of juice in order to write a negative story. Wow. Except that some people started to look more closely at the data and realized that perhaps Broder's story wasn't so crazy, and Musk made a number of assumptions that aren't necessarily backed up by the data. So, on Thursday, last Thursday, CNN reporter took the same drive and made it to Boston, though not without some anxiety that the car wouldn't run out of juice. The key issue that CNN stated was that it's not the car itself, but the location of the charging stations, since the Tesla battery pack is good for only about 270 miles. And to kind of cap off this whole sort of issue, on the 14th, Broder once again took to his defense with a point-by-point responses to specific assertions that Elon Musk had made. Now, looking at this...
This is a classic PR foible by Tesla. I mean, classic foible, right? Like, you can't screw up more than going to the gray lady, the paper of record, and saying that your high-class reporter, how could they, like, you know, even consider... You know, destroying, you know, like shitting on my car that is so awesome that, like, it's got rave review, you know, car and driver, car of the year. And you're going to say my car, like, fucked up in this, like, stupid way.
Well,
how
you know,
dare you?
Elon Musk confronted the New York Times because famously, Top Gear did it to them before with
the Roadster. There was a review of the Roadster in which Top Gear basically said the car is awesome and. At the same time, we're going to find a couple little nits and just stick with them instead of talking about the whole experience.
Well,
the Top Gear piece was awful.
Well, and the Top Gear piece featured them featured the car stalling, and Elon Musk found out later on that this was a scripted sort of event.
But that's Top Gear is the issue. Top Gear is not news. Top Gear is a theatrical presentation. Top Gear is basically Jon Stewart's show for cars.
Sure, but
New York Times is a real situation.
It was spurred on by that event. Elon Musk said that he started keeping logs anytime any member of the press took a drive in the Tesla.
Yeah, I mean, that's a smart thing to do, to keep those logs and everything. But I mean, how much better would it have been if Elon Musk had called up this reporter and said, hey, let's sit down. Let's talk about what you did. I got a couple of my scientists here. You bring your data, your notes and everything. Bring whomever you want. Let's sit around a table and let's really work together to figure out what happened here. Because maybe we might have to think about changing some of what we did. Changing, you know, whatever. Part of the reason why you have these reviews and have these, like, tests by these media elite people and everything is to understand the things that you couldn't have thought of. These people are professional question askers, professional get to the bottom of thingies.
Yeah.
And the concept that, okay, your car, which you have designed and tested between like LA and Las Vegas, two of the most nice climates in the country, may have a shorter battery life when hanging out in the wintertime in on the eastern seaboard. That's something that, like, really piques the interest of everybody who's ever thought of taking a road trip in one of these fancy new electric cars. You know, maybe you should – obviously, you should test it yourself first if you're smart and then give it to the reporter. But if you are going to get a bad review, then before you shoot out, sit them down. Figure out what happened. It was just classic PR blunder.
Well, you know, and also the takeaway for me on this issue was, as Mark Twain once said, there are three kinds of lies. Lies damn lies and statistics. And it's clear to me that from this back and forth, that this same data can be interpreted in a way for both parties to be wrong in a way.
Yes, Shakespeare said it himself. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose, right? So that's really what it comes down to. You can look at these stats. This guy says that he was in the car. I mean, like, there's also the idea that if you read the article closely, there are certain things that, you know, Tesla's service kind of screwed up on. And one of them was that when the gentleman called into the Tesla company worried about the mileage of the car, the range of the car, the person on the line, the emergency assistance person, gave him some advice that was not helpful to the longevity of the car's life. Now it's going to be the reporter's word against the word of the person, or maybe the call was recorded, but she gave him some advice regarding like turning on heat, turning off heat, doing whatever, and that advice ended up like losing the car's battery, you know, like hurting the car's battery life even more. So there is that. I mean, but the experience, he said, was horrific. The idea that his knuckles were turning white because it was 30 degrees inside the car. I mean, nobody wants that. Right.
That's not a comfortable drive. Yeah. If you have to like do that in order to squeeze out the mileage of that car, then there's something wrong with the whole process.
What they need is that car that Tosin was talking about made by Google, which drives the thing for you. It's not going to screw up. That's not going to screw up driving you around. It may kill you on the way in order to keep the battery going. But, you know, you can maybe use the three laws of robotics to keep that from happening.
Well, and like CNN said, I think the real problem is it's too early. It's early days, yet there are not enough charging stations. You know, when more charging stations get rolled out, then we'll have another sort of review of a New York to Boston run. But
it was like Washington, D.C. or something. Then he goes to Delaware and he gets there at half a tank. They fill the tank up. I'm calling it a tank. It's not a tank. I feel like I'm in the original Star Trek with memory banks. They fill the battery up. So Washington to Delaware, fill the battery up. Delaware on the way to Connecticut. So through New York in order to get to Connecticut. And that's a, I don't know, I think it was a 200-mile or stretch or 160-mile stretch or something like that. And because of the cold and all the rest of it, the car just didn't make it, according to the reporter. He got within 10 miles or some other close number, and the flatbed truck had to come out, pick up the car, take it to the station, and charge it up. It takes about an hour to charge it on full charge. Now, you and I, Tosin, anybody who's listening to this podcast, knows that whenever anybody gives you a battery quote, you know, 10 hours for an iPad, 4 hours for a laptop, whatever, you definitely drop that by like 30%, you know? Because that quote is like, if it's playing a loop of video of an antelope chewing some grass and then prancing away for that duration and doing only that, then you're going to be fine. But if you're like trying to watch like one of these god-awful Michael Bay Transformers movies where there's like guns and bullets blazing everywhere and robots are transforming and whatever, and you want to deign to open a web browser, your shit is going to be like 45 minutes, you know? Yeah. So there is some of that. I think there's a lot of posturing. The reporter's ego was probably definitely attacked. You know, he felt he was attacked by Mr. Musk. Mm-hmm. Musk, obviously, you know, self-proclaimed Iron Man, has put a lot into this vehicle. This vehicle is important.
And this whole situation occurred. I mean, I think one of the reasons that Elon Musk was so aggressive about this was this was like a week before Tesla's earnings call. So he was on the defense.
Right. Yeah. And you know what? I think they're both in the wrong. I'm sure he made something wrong. You know, the reporter had some mistakes, which were clearly his fault. Tesla, you know, like you said, you can't just analyze it strictly from the data. There's probably other things you're missing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think ultimately the world turns. We know that the Teslas will improve, or at least we hope they'll improve. It'll become it's still, I think overall most people agree that it's a pretty solid car and that they're only good things for its future.
Yeah, I mean, there's mixed reviews, sure, because you've got the one review from this guy saying, yay, whatever. You got the, I think it was the Engadget review or the CNET review, where they were like, oh, some of the stitching's off with the leather. They still got some time to go when it comes to, you know, getting up to Mercedes and BMW. And I mean, as a consumer who's interested in a Tesla car, I'm like, okay, whatever. If some stitching's off, yeah. whatever. I want a 17-inch screen in the middle of my car, and I want to be able to get Pandora running, and I want my 4G, and you know, I want all that. You know, right. Like that's not going to dissuade me. You read the Motor Trend situation where they put it up against all these conventionally powered cars, and boom, you can't get past that. I mean, they did a really good job when you look at those. You know, if you were to trust their processes, you know, the car of the year is the Tesla Model S. Now, if that's not enough to say that there's a future for this vehicle or this type of vehicle, you know, that's crazy. Now, there are competitors to Tesla. Fisker's one. I don't think anyone really sees that as a competitor. It's a car whereupon it's got a gas engine. I mean, not a gas engine, a gas tank and an alternator, and that powers its electric engine, so you can just fill it up, you know, with gasoline, and then you can, like, it'll charge the electric engine, which is the electric motor, which is going to pull the car forward 100 miles a gallon. That's great. But from the truly conventional side, you've got these hybrid diesel vehicles that Volkswagen's been putting out. They put out a 76 mile per gallon car, you know, maybe a few years ago. And then Porsche came out with the 918, which is like a 70 or 80 mile a gallon hybrid sports car using diesel. And then just recently, and this is in the show notes, there is a 261 diesel mile per gallon vehicle that Volkswagen just laid out. It only seats two people. And I'm sure it doesn't go anywhere near as fast as the Roadster or the Model S. But, you know, these things are creeping up. So Tesla really has to get the kind of lead that that's, you know, that 5 years ahead of everybody else lead in order to take its car and make it a mainstream item. And so I think that Elon Musk is incredibly sensitive to that.
Sure.
And he's going to take things, granted, very personally. Everyone told him, you can't start a car company. It's ridiculous. It's a waste of money. Look at the car companies. So he's gone through a lot of adversity, and I just hope that he can use that mentality, that mindset, that personal vision and ability to lead to take it to the next level without letting things like this get in the way of his success. They're always going to be naysayers. Mm-hmm. Screw up with the New York Times. This is your stuff. Get with the New York Times. You can't beat them, so join them. You know?
Another thing I wanted to talk about in sort of a meta issue over all this was noted by Matthew Ingram of Paid Content. And he says that one thing that Tesla's battle with the New York Times has reinforced is how the balance of power has shifted in media now that everyone, companies included, has the ability to publish their side of the story. In a very real sense, Tesla Motors is a media company with all or at least most of the same tools of influence at its disposal as the New York Times. People and entities that used to seem primarily as sources of information for the news media to make use of, whether a company or a politician, a celebrity or an entity like WikiLeaks, have the ability to reach out to potential supporters and detractors directly without having to go through traditional intermediaries like newspapers or journalists or even marketing firms or public relations advisors. So, you know, with Elon Musk taking the initiative to fight his own battle publicly on the Tesla blog, he is the media voice for Tesla Motors, and every bit as much of a presence as the New York Times.
Yeah, and it wasn't some spokesperson for Tesla that went after the New York Times. It was Elon Musk. It was the founder and CEO, right? Mm-hmm. So that does say something. We're talking about this as if, you know, people, I mean, we live in an age where, yes, everyone has a mouthpiece and everything, but there was a time of yellow journalism where there were newspapers everywhere. There was the New York Herald, there was the New York this and the New York that. They'd always, you know, you could always pay off a newspaper to say what you got to say. But now I think this guy's right. This ability to directly contribute what a newspaper is saying, if people are going to listen to you, that is something. And what do? If you're a newspaper, do you pander? No, you can't, or else you'll get the reputations that certain news outlets have that no one respects. If you're them, you have to stand behind your reporter. But then you have like that the New York Times reporter, Jason whomever, from, you know, maybe 10 years ago, African-American reporter, trying to just drum up his name in my head. But he's a young hotshot at the New York Times, and he was found to not have been at places he was reporting on. He was found to just have screwed up. He was, you know, a rising star in the organization, and he was found to just kind of like have been lazy mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. not done the work. And so the Times got marred, and you know, Elon Musk no doubt remembers that. So there's a question as to any newspapers, any news organizations, actual, like when they do the op-ed, when they do whatever, their actual reporting. And I think he was capitalizing on that and not also just not realizing that his emotions were getting in the way of his goals, right, which should never happen when you have a goal as lofty as his.
We're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, Sony announces the PlayStation 4. Are you excited? I am. What does it look like? Who knows? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Unifowakin. Sony announced their next-gen console, the PlayStation 4, at an event in New York City earlier this week, but something was missing. Bizarrely, the company elected not to show any glimpse of the console hardware itself, instead focusing on internal details in a showreel of upcoming games. We did get to see the new DualShock 4 controller and the depth camera that it works with, but as for what you'll actually place under your TV come holiday 2013, we're none the wiser. Sony didn't announce pricing or a specific release date either, which was to be expected. Here's some of the things we do know about the device. It's got x86 64-bit architecture, so they've completely ditched the core processor, which is understandable. I mean, and they mentioned that this is going to make it easier to port over games across platforms like the PC.
It is essentially like it's running PC hardware. Yeah. The hard drive, DDR5 RAM, and the CPU, which is it's very similar to what you find in your laptop or desktop.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be capable of 1.84 trillion floating point calculations. It's going to have Bluetooth 2.1, Blu-ray. It's going to continue to have a Blu-ray and DVD drive. And Sony squashed rumors earlier this week that the device wasn't going to be able to play used games. It will be able to play used games.
Used games or old games?
Used games used to be game. Playing.
So, like, if I bought a game and I was done using it, and then I gave it to my friend Mr. Onifowakin over there, and he would have put it in his machine, because of whatever code gets transmitted to the Sony servers, like, oh, no, this is Dwayne's game. You can't use it,
right,
Tosin.
Right. As far as backwards compatibility, it's not going to be backward compatible with the PS3. But they did say that they're working on a way to they hope to. So once again, this is like blue sky, pie in the sky goals here. They're hoping to get older games to be able to play on it in a sort of, I'm not sure, in a sort of emulation mode. And we'll talk about that in a second, too, because that ties into
it's also got 16 times the RAM of a current PlayStation.
Yes. Yes.
That's crazy.
Did you see some of the games that they demonstrated? Yeah, I mean, that was really the big show of this launch event, was that the games they had on display here.
Were you guys impressed with those games?
Well, so here's the problem. Well, for one, one of them is a problem on my part, because I watched the stream live as it was occurring, and you know, for anyone who's watching the stream, it's hard to tell. For one, it's hard to tell quality of what you're looking at.
Right.
But the second thing, of course, is for these games, it's really hard to tell if that's actual gameplay or if that's just cutscene or theoretical. Or it's
amen, man.
You can't tell.
Now this is one of those situations.
That's the worst part.
Yeah,
you can't trust them.
This
you
is one
know.
Of those situations where I'm totally on board, Dwayne, with what you were saying about with your criticisms about Google Glass. In this case, I feel it's really valid. I mean, we're seeing sort of pie in the sky, like, you know, concept, but this is all concept.
It's crazy because, like, you're seeing this game footage, and, like, it's not like they've got the console there and they put the game disc in there, or they've, you know, use whatever downloadable content they have on it. They're not, like, you can't see that they're playing it from the console. You just have to trust them. And that's my problem. I don't know. Maybe I'm a paranoid American, but I don't trust anybody. So I look at it and I'm just like, I guess get flashbacks to Nokia during CES, right? Like, is it real? I don't know if it's real. Is it a cutscene? Also, there was one game that they showed. I forgot which one. And that recent port was for a year-old game that was on the Windows platform.
Diablo
3?
Yeah, Diablo 3, exactly. How could I forget that? You know, Diablo 3 has been out for a year or more, and, you know, they're showing it on this PS4 architecture when I feel like it just got to the PS3, or at least it was announced that it was going to be on the PS3. So am I supposed to be impressed that a game that can play on the 7th generation hardware is going to be playable on the 8th generation hardware? I don't know. And there's also the idea that, like, what I'm really worried about, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, because in the years following the turn of the millennium, HD televisions came out, but there was a dearth of HD content.
Yeah.
When we look at the 7th generation of consoles, the Wii, the Xbox 360, and the PlayStation 3, they've been around since 2005 or 6. That's 7 to 8 years of them being around. When CES 2013 is showing me 8K video television sets, and the PlayStation 4 is rumored to be rolling out with HDMI, I'm a little bothered by the fact that I can spend $300+ on a brand new console, and within a few years when my 8K TV shows up, or my 4K TV shows up for that matter, I plug it in and it's like, you know, what's considered legacy HD video out. Am I going to have to spend $200 on a special box that's going to, you know, push and, like, you know, double the pixels?
There were no specs as far as that goes. We don't know if it outputs 4K video or not. We know
that it has an HDMI out, and do know that it has some analog out. That's like the stuff that I've been reading. So we do know it has that. The fact that they didn't speak to 8K support for a device that's going to come out in possibly late 2013, early 2014. Screw 8K, just 4K support. That to me says a lot. That to me says, yeah. You know, my sirens once again go on with the vaporware thing.
I mean, 4K is pretty new, isn't it? In terms of, like,
yeah, sure, but it is still Sony. They make TVs. You think that they think about that?
Yeah, I think one of the other things that actually kind of what made me think a little bit is they're really driving the social aspect with this console or prototype or vaporware and. The one thing, as well as even downloading games, downloading content, being able to multitask, and I started thinking, how does Comcast feel about all this? Like, I started thinking of, like, this is when you start seeing a lot more people realizing that they're getting rate limited for trying to download or do too much.
But do you think the social networking is really a problem? I don't think me sharing – I mean, I guess sharing a clip of a video, yeah, that's a thing. But I know Comcast came out recently saying – that they were going to get rid of the caps for data usage on their networks.
Really?
Yeah, well, they said that they were looking with Xfinity and Xfinity Plus or whatever. They were looking at a way to basically saying, like, mean usage is not at a place where we need to cap it. And also they're competing against other companies that want to cap it or whatever. So
Yeah, I still have my doubts against them not trying to charge for doing such a thing, and not trying to charge a hefty price, which most, which I find a lot of people will probably not suddenly think about paying and just realize that they're running into issues. Like, just thinking of a typical household, you know, they get internet, but I don't feel like they really think about going, going with high internet packages in terms of speed.
Yeah, no, you're right. They don't want to. I mean, if you're going to do a lot of these advanced things, yeah, if you're going to do some of these advanced things, I'm pretty sure you're going to have to, like, pony up. And you know what would be really smart is if Sony came out with some sort of, like, they work with Comcast and with Time Warner and with Cablevision to come out with an optimized plan, or at the very least work with them to determine what they need to do to sort of compress their data in a way that is helpful and get it to YouTube, get it to Facebook, get it to wherever it needs to go.
Well, you know, there's
also the Netflix and all this other stuff they want you to be able to, because it sounds like for the longest time, until we saw the specs that there was going to be a drive, the entire press conference sounded like there wasn't going to be a drive. You know, they're like, well, you can just download your game from online. Right. You don't have to think about anything. They didn't mention anything about the disc.
Right.
It is.
I mean,
this
should be an after. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think we've had this discussion before, and I think myself and maybe a few others on the podcast, or myself and Andrew at least, like the physical medium. And I think
you guys
want to
kill
Blu-rays.
The environment. Okay. For me, I would rather. I mean, I'm the guy. I mean, Annie and I have had long conversations where I've told him about how I've taken every single disc I have and I've transferred it to a hard drive, and I have that on, you know, backed up, and then I have that attached to the Apple TV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to ever. I don't ever. You know, I don't really care what the PlayStation 4 looks like, because I'll never see it. It'll go into a cabinet. It'll get zapped. You know, it'll have wireless controllers, mm-hmm. and I'll turn it on for my controller, and all my content should be downloaded. I should never have to look at the device ever, because I just want it to work wirelessly in its, you know, case, wherever it is, you know, getting some air, hopefully, so it doesn't explode, because it's going to be running this crazy 8-core processor. I don't want – I mean, the fact that it's going to play a Blu-ray, great. As my default Blu-ray player, it's better than most Blu-ray players, the PlayStation.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's not a bad thing. But in order to play a game, I don't want to have to go fish out the disc. If they can, like with these wonderful Blizzard games, you know, I download the stuff from my account onto the device. So I'll go to, like, you know, battle.net. I'll download StarCraft 2 to whatever new computer I have. I'll put, you know, it understands my key because I put in my password. That's how I have an access to it. And that's it. I'm ready to go. Like, why should I want to go and pick up a disc and all that other stuff like that? Now, the hard drive's got to be nice and large in order to accommodate that.
Yeah.
And I don't care. You know, the current PlayStation allows you to throw in any drive you want, and it'll format it for you and work. That's always been a nice thing, because the Xbox has been very confusing as to its hard drives, the way they lock them down and so on and so forth. But, I mean... Well, the cloud thing, all that stuff. Like,
well, let's talk a little bit about that.
Let's
talk a little bit about the PlayStation 4 and the cloud, the whole cloud aspect of it. Now, last July, Sony purchased a cloud streaming company called Gaikai, which is kind of like
Of money too.
Yeah, and they essentially did what OnLive did, and we've talked about OnLive before on this show. It's essentially streaming video. Live streaming video where you can play games and all of the sort of the CPU tasks are taken up on the server on their end, was the OnLive method. I'm not entirely sure how Gaikai does it, but supposedly during this media event, they mentioned that what the PlayStation can do via their Gaikai technology is you can have streaming PS3, PS2, and PS1 games, and ostensibly that would be how you would be able to do backwards compatibility, since you've already purchased the license for those PS3 games. They just use your license to stream the game to you via Gaikai. you can instantly play new games while they're still downloading in the background, and maybe that speaks a little bit towards the compression aspect that we were talking about in saving our cable providers from all the data throughput. Instant game demos without having to download anything, and a remote play that enables the Vita to run PlayStation 4 games as well. So, I mean, I think that like I was really hoping that OnLive would continue to take off, because I feel that that whole cloud streaming thing is the way of the future. Some of the stumbles to that technology is that, at least in OnLive's case, it wasn't necessarily as smooth, or there was maybe a little bit of lag time, a hint of lag time there, and hopefully they've overcome that with the Gaikai technology. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, that's the reason that I still kind of feel tied to physical media. Yeah,
so like the way I look at it, like, what do I want to avoid when I'm playing a game? I want to avoid the load screen. That's usually a question of memory rather than downloadable content. But I do want to avoid that. I want a big hard drive. I want a 3 terabyte hard drive in this thing, because I don't care how big it is, right? And I want that to download the game just like I would, again, with the Blizzard paradigm. I go to Blizzard. I go to download it. It opens up something that reminds me of a torrent downloader, yeah. And I get the game pretty quickly. Now I have to download the whole game before I can play it. With today's technology, you should be able to download pieces of it. I think there's a certain Netflix aspect to what you're saying, mm-hmm. where you're getting a piece of it first that's playable, and selling the other stuff in the background. If it has enough processors and enough RAM, it can actually pull that off without you really noticing it. So I really want more of a. I'm okay with a little like, hey, it's going to take 5 minutes for you to download the first part of this game. The first, like, you know, 20, 40 minutes of gameplay or whatever, if I've got a nice 30 megabit connection. But even so, the idea that when you put a disk in, it's going to copy a whole bunch of files to the hard drive on the console anyhow, that's a thing. You know, like, it's going to be playing this off of the hard drive. It's not going to be playing this off of the disk. And why? Because in many ways, that's a wear and tear problem for you in a way that a disk drive just isn't. And I really feel like the physical disc is an issue. Now, the idea that you can use the Vita as a controller, mm-hmm. you know, that is something that I think it's a very nice to have. You know, like, if you're playing that driving game, you look into your Vita, and the Vita is your rear view mirror. I mean, that's cool. You know, that's just, it's kind of great. And I think that's going to drive adoption of Vitas for the whole experience. Sort of like, when the iPad first came out and Scrabble had its game that allowed you to get on the Wi-Fi, and if you had an iPhone, that could be the thing that holds your letters while you play Scrabble on the actual iPad. That kind of thing. That kind of integration, that's where Sony needs to go if it wants to survive, because people love that sort of thing. It drives the adoption of your products. And Sony did say that they're going to allow for other smart devices like iPhones and iPads to integrate into their system.
Sure.
It's
part of that whole sharing thing.
Yeah, so if I could have, I mean, that's not a Comcast issue, that's a Wi-Fi issue.
Yeah.
So if I can have my iPad sitting there with the game map on it, you know, with a little avatar of where I am, and I'm trying to run through, you know, some dungeon,
yeah.
and takes the shit up. That's the kind of experience
that's essentially the Wii U, except with the power of next gen gaming.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where I want to be. I want to be at a place where I download my PlayStation Companion app, you know, and I'm running that on, like, you know, my Nexus tablet or my iPad or whatever, and or my Sony tablet, right? Maybe Sony's tablets are going to come back in a big way, because they have the hardware that's specifically dedicated to running this kind of thing, and I'm able to, like, really use these multiple screens in order to maximize my view situation on the television set, while still using the second and third screens as, you know, like, I'm tweeting my position on the map to this person via my iPad while I'm running around, you know, on this thing. And I have, like, let's say I've got some sort of, like, little, like, what's it called? Like a familiar, like I've got a dog or a bird or whatever that's helping out my dungeon character out, and it's going and flying around. I can see that screen. I can see what they're seeing through my PlayStation Vita screen as I use it as a controller. I mean, that's the dream, right? That's the dream.
Yeah.
And if they could pull that kind of stuff off, that's really what's going to get me excited. Reading about 8 cores and 8 gigs of RAM and not sure whether or not it's going to support an 8 gig. 8 seems to be the number this year. And 8K TV and all that other shit. That's where I get thrown off. I don't understand why Sony can't give us a date. I don't need a price, but a date.
Holiday, 2013. So it'll be ready by the holidays.
I feel like that wasn't really confirmed.
They had a big sign that was one of the very last things that they projected.
Oh, because it was one of the very last things. I left early.
Yeah, it said holiday 2013.
Okay, good.
It's interesting also some of the things that they've updated the eye, so it's essentially just like the Microsoft Kinect. It uses two cameras to capture the 3D depth of field. And they said
does it need to be on all the time?
I think so. Yeah, it's got two cameras and 4 microphones capable of isolating sounds at their source. They said that it can detect players independent of what they're holding. So, I mean, essentially, just like the Kinect. It also works with there's illuminated light bars on the top of each new DualShock 4, so that it will work with those light bars and determine where players are sitting and arrange what's on screen based on that information. The new DualShock 4 has a touch screen on the front, a share button to automatically share experiences. I think that using that enables that Gaikai technology and allow you to basically pause your game. Built-in stereo headphone jack on the console, on the controller, on the DualShock 4 controller.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Option button replaces the functionality of start and select.
Mm-hmm.
Built-in speaker, just like the Wiimotes.
The ability to tell who is player one and who is player two.
Uh huh. Well, those are the different colored LEDs on the front face of the.
Those will indicate which player is which.
Yeah, which is something they've severely lacked.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I gotta say I don't sit in front of these seventh generation consoles wanting for much, but the features that I'm seeing possibly coming out of the Xbox, definitely coming out of the PlayStation 4, they're features that kind of remind me of the Lexus Toyota divide, right? You can get a Toyota that does everything you need it to do and you're really, really happy. But then you sit in a Lexus, which is, it could be the same exact, vehicle with a different chassis and more amenities. And it's like, oh, what was I doing before? And that's really the feeling that I'm getting here. They've added a level of luxury and common senseness to this, the controller in particular,
mm-hmm.
that I'm excited about. I am excited about that. If it's not $600, I'm really going to consider getting one. Because the idea of the touch screen, the idea of the options, the layout of it, how it's not totally different from what was there before, but it's significantly different enough for me to want to get into it. And having played with the Vita and looking at where they wanted to move that technology and knowing that some of that functionality is going to be imbued in this new device, that is a turn on. So I'm excited about that. And they said that there's like multiple logons are going to be possible.
Yep.
And that is huge because how many times have you gone over to a friend's house and it's quantified self? You want to, you're playing some shooter game against your friends and you want to rack that score up.
You want to
be you. Andy, that is the phrase. They should take that shit and put that in the commercial. You want to be you. You want to be you. So the idea that I can like be me at my friend's house, just log in. And they know what I like, and from a marketing perspective, Patrick Rowenhouse would hate this, but from a marketing perspective, I know what you like now, and I could market you the deal on these upgrades or whatever on this game or whatever because I have that information on my platform, all that stuff. So I don't know. I think the real big thing is here. Are they going to allow independent developers to develop games for this in the way that we began to see on the PlayStation 3 in a much larger scale? I'm talking iPhone, Android level development for support for independent developers instead of having the same 4 companies make up games.
Some of the people that they did talk to were Jonathan Blow, who did Braid. He's developing a game called The Witness for the PS4. Also, I think there were a couple of other sort of smaller independent developers who showed off some of the stuff that they had.
Debuted the first game they debuted was his game, which is a more indie flavor type game.
I'd like to see more of that. It's the business development that's really, you know, obviously with these consoles, is what games do you have, and if they could show us, just like how Facebook has an app development head person, if that person could show up and be like, "Hi, I'm the guy who the indie people need to come to, because I've got the digs on like getting the hardware early and doing all that stuff." You know, like building that community, that would go a huge way into making the PlayStation have an advantage over the Xbox, which it seems to have lost in the last few years.
I can't wait to see what Genova Chen and that game company do with the PlayStation 4. You know, the ones that developed Flow and Flower and Journey.
Journey, yeah. I mean, Journey. Fantastic. So, I mean, like, we need to see some more of that Journey stuff happening on these consoles. And we need to see that in a big, big way. And I think that we need to see that in a way where Sony encourages the use of those independent games across multiple devices. You know, like, I don't know, like, you, Andy, you've read Ready Player One, and you know how they have games within the games.
Yeah.
Or, Tosin, maybe you've played StarCraft II. And you've played like the Galaga type game on the bridge of the ship or whatever, stuff like that, where you can win little bonuses inside, you know, like on your iPhone or on your Android phone, when you're like on the bus or something, you know, things that enhance the experience of that particular bit of special content. That's what I'm really excited about, because I think they have the power to make the infrastructure even more powerful than the console.
Any last thoughts or any last words on the PlayStation 4 before we wrap it up?
I'm excited for it. I hope it looks as good as our hopes are about its functionality.
We'll see when we'll see it. I'm not a typical gamer anymore. I mainly use my consoles for media streaming, so there's nothing which makes me want to run out and grab one. At this moment.
See, that's the thing. I don't use my consoles at all. I've been waiting for really awesome functionality to use them. Like, I just, when I want to watch Netflix, I have an Apple TV. When I want to do other stuff, I have, you know, a Sony connected TV. I haven't used, my consoles collect dust.
PS3 is still my primary Blu-ray and Netflix watching system.
Blu-ray and...
Blu-ray is my only, it's the only thing I use my PS3 for right
PlayStation
now.
Media Center. Gotta love that.
Yeah, I'm still tied to this Apple TV thing, especially because I can do the, I'll look up something on YouTube, you know, my watch later list on my iPad, and I'll just shoot it over or something like that. For me, if they could really integrate multiple devices and get me excited about, not unlike Artemis, right? Get me excited about having multiple screens showing me stuff that matter to gameplay, then I'll really get immersed, and I'll feel that feeling again where I want to, like, you know, get my girlfriend out of the house for 10 hours so I can really, you know, zoom into something that's not going to do anything for me but make my eyes tired, you know.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on twitter.com/Dwayne, DDWAYNED. You can also find what I'm up to at flavors.me/Dwayne, DDWAYNED. And I guess next week or the week after, I'll have a pretty fun announcement for the group.
Boy.
So I'm excited about that.
Right.
Something I've been working on for a while. And yeah, that's my story.
He's getting Google Glass.
it's all smokescreen. All this dissing on Google Glass is smokescreen.
I wasn't dissing. I'm just saying that it's just, we can't get excited because it's not there. And I am a man of proper expectations. I love Google. It's just proper expectations.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast, TOAST 4321. You can also find my random rabblings and discussions of movies at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can just Google Mr. Baby Man and you'll find all my social links over there. As for the show, check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is on the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, other devices by going to stitcher.com, facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is a wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us. Are you excited? I am. What does it look like? Who knows?
Jason Blair. Jason Blair. That was what it was.
Oh, Jason Blair. Jason Blair. You stepped on my outro.
Let's do that all over again. I think you should do that all over again.
Okay. All right. Here we go.